Some of you asked last week who in the world this guy Belshazzar was and where'd he come from. And he was a descendant of, well, let me just show you. It's easier to show you than to tell you. This is a list of some of the Babylonian kings. Just look at the top half of this so it's a little easier to try to track. These are the kings of the Babylonian Empire over here. Here's Nebuchadnezzar. We've been talking about him for some time. Well, his dad was a guy named Nabopolassar, and he died when Nebuchadnezzar was down in Egypt fighting them. He then left to go back to Babylon to assume the throne, and that's when he besieged Jerusalem and took Daniel captive. So Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel kind of begin their career in the book of Daniel at the same time right here. He reigned for like 43 years. And then when he died, he had these three guys succeeded him. And as you can see, none of them lasted very long. One of them died of natural causes pretty quick. That was like one of his sons. And then a second one was assassinated pretty quick, like he didn't last very long either. And then another one came on the scene here. And then this guy Nabonidus took over the reins in Babylon. He was more like a son-in-law to Nebuchadnezzar. And he is actually ruling Babylon during this time frame. And he's out also fighting at the time that we pick up chapter 5 here. And his son, this guy, Belshazzar, is in sort of, he's trying to hold down the farm. So Nabonidus is actually the king of Babylon at this time. His son is ruling while he's out fighting somewhere. He never comes back, by the way. He gets captured and later dies in exile. So he never comes back here where this guy is killed off. So Belshazzar is his son, and that's who we're actually seeing in charge and running Babylon at this time. Okay, you got a feel for this now? All right. I don't think he's cut from the same piece of cloth as he was. But, you know, if you're in line, you're in line. So he gets to rule the place for a little while. All right. He's the guy that called the feast when the Medo-Persians were surrounding Babylon and about to take the place. He puts his feast together to try to convince all of his nobles and everybody that there ain't nothing to worry about. This is the Medo-Persian Empire here, all this area and through here. They're surrounding Babylon and are about to take the place at the time of this feast. So outside the walls of this feast is this invading army that's got the city surrounded. And I'll tell you how they got in here in just a little bit. So he has this feast, in which case he's going to try to convince everybody that they don't need to worry about anything. They got the Medo-Persians pretty well under control, and who gives a flip about them anyway? They got plenty of food, plenty of water in town. They got this big fortified city of Babylon. So they don't care. And so they're having a feast to kind of shore up their self-confidence and whatnot. And we saw last time, about the middle of that feast, there's this hand, a hand only, that writes on the wall of the room that they're in. It's not attached to a full body because it doesn't matter. It's only the message that matters anyway. And so it writes some stuff on the wall and scares the daylights out of everybody. So Belshazzar doesn't know what to do. He calls in all the wise men from Babylon and whatnot, and they can't do anything. They don't know how to interpret whatever this message is. So his mother bails him out and reminds him that there is a man in his kingdom. This is verse 11 of Daniel 5. There's a man in his kingdom who can understand this kind of stuff. He did it back in the days of your grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, and he can probably help you out. So good old mom comes to the rescue for this wuss and gets him some help. So they get Daniel, verse 13 is where we want to pick up the trail this morning. They bring Daniel in before the king, and the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the exiles from Judah, who my father the king brought from Judah?" Remember, that's exactly how he got there. We saw all that earlier on. He says, "Now I've heard about you that a spirit of the gods is in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. Well, if he knew so much about him, how come his mother had to remind him and tell him? But at any rate, he says whatever he wants to say. Just now the wise men and the conjurers were brought in before me that they might read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me, but they could not declare the interpretation of the message. My homegrown boys couldn't cut it here. They don't know what this means. But I personally have heard about you, that you're able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you're able to read the inscription and make interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple and wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you will have authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. And someone asked, well, what's the third ruler? Well, if you remember that chart, it's because he can't give away his dad's job, Nabonidus here. He ain't going to give away his job. So the next one is the third ruler in the kingdom. So that's why he says that. He's going to make him as high in the Babylonian Empire as he can, but can't give away dad's job or his. So, like a lot of guys think in this life, if you throw enough money at a problem, you can solve it. So that's the approach he's taking there. But Daniel answered back, verse 17, and said before the king, keep your gifts for yourself, or give your rewards to someone else. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him. So Daniel isn't motivated by the opportunity here to get rich, like most men would have been. He just says, you keep all that stuff for yourself, but I'll tell you what it means nevertheless. Verse 18, O King, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father. My God granted to your father, it's actually his grandfather, but there's not a word for grandfather in the Aramaic, it's just father, so it could be multiple generations back. You just have to figure it out some other way. It's actually his grandfather. It reminds him that God granted that to him, and because of the grandeur which he, God, bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished he killed, and whomever he wished he spared alive, and whomever he wished he elevated, and whomever he wished he humbled. Remember the vision in chapter 2, the head of the four-sectioned statue was gold. That was Nebuchadnezzar. He was the best leader of the four there. And God granted him that leadership. And Daniel reminds his grandson of that. But he had a problem. Verse 20, when his heart was lifted up and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was disposed from his royal throne and his glory was taken away from him. Remember that history? He got to be a cow for 7 years? Or we think 7 years, 7 units of time. We're saying it's years. I don't know exactly what it is, but we're going to talk about it like that. He lost his mind for 7 years. Remember that story? Until he learned that God controls the affairs of men. Remember the lesson last week, chapter 4? So Daniel reminds him of that. And he was driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like that of beasts, and his dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and that he sets over it whomever he wishes. Nebuchadnezzar had to learn it the hard way. He had to be a cow for 7 years. He could have learned it the easy way, but he chose not to. God controls the affairs of men. God controls the affairs of the state of government in all respects. Keep that in mind. God puts who he wants in place, and he takes away whoever he wants. And he can put in place the lowliest of men. That lesson taught us there in chapter 4. Yet you, his son, Belshazzar, you have not humbled yourself even though you knew all of this. Somewhere down the line he had been taught this lesson. He had been reminded of all of this from his family probably, that his grandfather had to be humiliated and become an animal for 7 years until he recognized that God controls the affairs of men. And Belshazzar knew and learned that lesson, but he still would not humble himself before God. You have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your nobles and your wives and your concubines have been drinking wine from them. That is, you have insulted God. You have shown contempt for him, the God that gave your father all of his glory and grandeur and had to teach him this lesson the hard way. You have insulted by drinking from his vessels. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron, wood and stone, idols, which do not see nor understand. But the God in whose hand are your life breath and your ways, you have not glorified. The God that owns you, Belshazzar, you have insulted and shown contempt for him. So then the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out. God sent the hand, which is good, because if it came from somewhere else, we know we'd have a real problem there. But God sent this hand, and he wrote this inscription on the wall, and the inscription was this. There's four words to the inscription. Meeni, meeni, tekel, upharsin, or Perez, depends on the interpretation of that last word. There's four words there. And your English Bible puts some vowels in those four words so that you can understand them. But they ain't there in the original writing. There are no vowels in the Aramaic. So all that would be there are the consonants. And remember, you read it from right to left. So the whole thing is not like what you're seeing in your English Bible there, but those are the words, meeni, meeni, tekel, upharsin. But the way it probably would appear, and it may have been read from top to bottom, that's a possibility too. So you've got this conglomerate of letters with no vowels, read from right to left, and from top to bottom, or from bottom to top, you're not sure. So it's just a collection of Z's and B's and D's and R's and K's, no vowels, just a collection of consonants scribbled on the wall. So they can't figure it out. They don't know what do we read from right to left. Do we put some A's and some E's and some I's and some O's and some U's in there? His wise men don't know what to do with this smattering of letters on the wall. But Daniel knows. He knows how to make sense of this collection of Aramaic consonants. He says, this is the interpretation, Hoss. Meaning the first word is a word that means God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. He probably isn't real thrilled now that he's getting this interpretation, is he? Actually got this somewhere. What'd I do with it? Where'd you hide that from me at? There it is over here. I need more workspace in this room, you know that? This is not enough workspace. All right. First word, meeni, is from a verb that means to be numbered. What it means is that God has sized up his kingdom and has numbered it and has reckoned it to be over. First word, Daniel says to him, is God has sized up your kingdom and he's not impressed with what he sees, and he says, you're done. You're through. And then he repeats it. That means you're really done. You're really through. The first two conglomerates of letters means that God has valued or looked at and assessed his kingdom, and it's over. Next word, tekel, means that he has sort of weighed it. He has compared it to what it should be, evaluated it in light of what a good leadership should be and all that kind of stuff, and has decided that, well, it's a little bit too light. Your kingdom is inadequate. You're a failure, Belteshazzar. And the last word, Euphorson or Perez, means that his kingdom has been divided and is going to be taken over by the Medes and the Persians. That comes from a word that means broken or divided. So the message to Belshazzar is, you're toast, pal. God has evaluated your kingdom and it is lacking, and he's going to take it away from you and give it to those guys outside the city that you don't think you have anything to be concerned about. So that's the message. It is a message of doom for Belshazzar. He's probably real sorry he asked for it, quite frankly. But that's what it is. So Belshazzar, true to his word at least, verse 29 says, he gave orders and he clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. So he gave him what he said he would do. Even though this was a very discouraging message for Belshazzar, he did what he said and he gave Daniel that position that he said. So there's the prophetic message from God and that hand that wrote the assortment of letters on the wall and the interpretation of them, Daniel knew, and it was a message of doom for Belteshazzar. Okay? Of course, we get our expression, the handwriting on the wall, from this, of course. Not hard to see why. Not always a message of doom, but the expression is, and it comes from here. Well, I wonder how long it took for all this to come about. Not long. That same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. Didn't take very long, did it? They didn't get to eat up all the food there at the banquet before they all got killed. And what happened was that the Medes and the Persians dammed up the Euphrates River and drained some of it off so that where it normally flowed under the city wall and it was too much wall below it to get into the city, they drained that river off and got it down low enough that they could get under the wall and into the city. So they made their entrance into Babylon via the Euphrates River that they dropped the level of so low that they could get under the city walls and into the city and took the place and killed this guy that very night. So this contemptible feast they were having to shore up their confidence that they didn't need to worry at all about the Medes and the Persians didn't work out so real very well. They were slain that very night. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. So the guy who takes over now in Babylon is this guy called Darius the Mede. Now there's a bunch of debate and controversy over exactly who this guy is, and it doesn't matter to us. We're not going to worry about it, but just be aware that there's some question as to exactly who he was, because the guy that's later spoken of as being in charge is named Cyrus. And so somebody says, well, what's the deal here? Is it Cyrus? Is it Darius? Who is it? Well, it could be both. It could be a co-regency. That's not unheard of by any means. And it could be some other explanation. So we're not going to worry about those, but just know that there's some stuff that goes on about them. I think it's still on this chart here. Could be a co-regency here, as you can see, and that may be the case. These are the Medo-Persian kings. So the Babylonian Empire ended right there with this invasion of Babylon by the next empire, the Medo-Persian Empire. Remember back to that vision in chapter 2. What happened after the head? The next section of that image was the torso, and it was an inferior kingdom to Babylon. And here it is right here. It only took 70 years for the vision in chapter 2 to start being fulfilled. Remember that? I know by popular demand you want to see my scratch here again, so I'll show it to you. those of you that wondered exactly what this vision looked like, the image looked like, here's what it looked like. So here we go. This section of the vision has now taken place 70 years later. Didn't take real long for that prophecy to start being fulfilled, did it? All right. So Daniel's been down there now about 70 years, remember? That's how long the Babylonian captivity was stated by Jeremiah that it would be. It would be 70 years. And it's just now ended. So he's been down there 70 years, went down there maybe as a mid to late teenager. So he's about 85, 87, something like that. Which, as we all know, that's no problem. He can still function perfectly fine at that age, can't he? All right. It doesn't say how many hip replacements he had to have or shoulder replacements or knees or whatever, but he's still cooking at about 87, whatever it is. Okay. So there's your first phase of this vision being fulfilled already in Daniel's lifetime. We're already now down to this phase of that vision, 70 years later. All right, any questions about this history before we go on? The vision in chapter 2 gave us this panorama of history from the time of Daniel down to Messiah, Second Advent, the times of the Gentiles, a succession of four world empires, each of which is a little more inferior than the previous one in some respects because of the nature of the metal that they were made of. And this one is the second one of that panorama now that is in place down there. Everybody in step with the history here, what's going on? Okay. Daniel chapter 6. Probably the most familiar Bible story that we have. Certainly maybe the most in the Old Testament. I guess David and Goliath and some of that stuff might be about as well known, but this is maybe the best known one of them all. So it seemed good to Darius. He's the guy that took over the Babylonian Empire following the death of Belshazzar. He decided to organize his new empire into 120 different, like, governorships, states, whatever you want to call them, satraps they're called here, over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of, and that they should be would be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them, three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one. So he's going to organize his newly founded empire here into 120 divisions, and three guys over those 120. Kind of a classic pyramidal arrangement here. So throughout his whole empire here, throughout all of this region, he puts 120 guys in charge and three guys over those 120. Each one of them would have authority over 40 guys. And Daniel was one of those three. Now, you want to ask a question?
You said that 120 divisions, not 120 people.
Well, each division had a guy over it. Okay, think of it as
the division could be 1,000 people or 20 people, whatever, but they're groups.
120 satraps, they're called. They're like governors. So you can think of them.
Which is the 120 groups of people.
120 different governorships in his empire.
Okay.
And over them was three guys who reported to him.
Okay.
Each guy had 40 governors or whatever you want to call them, satraps, that he was responsible for. And Daniel was one of those three. Now, we've seen before, not everybody's real happy with the governmental practice of putting these foreigners in charge of anything. Daniel's a foreigner in this empire. And we'll see how that works out. And the whole purpose, of course, was that he wouldn't suffer any loss. These guys are supposed to be in charge and watch over these guys. Verse 2 there. 6:3, then when Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Well, it didn't take long for Daniel to kind of outperform his peers. And Darius sees this pretty quick. Like he said, I'm going to put this guy in charge of the whole place. Well, you think everybody's happy about that? I can think of at least two guys that ain't happy about it. The other two supervisors, or whatever you want to call them, they're probably not happy about it. But Daniel distinguishes himself because clearly God is with him. God has blessed this man from his youth, as we've seen in this book over and over again. So there grows up in the Medo-Persian Empire sort of a deep state of people that ain't happy with certain members of Darius's administration, i.e. Daniel. They don't like Daniel being there. So the commissioners, that would be perhaps some of the 120, I don't know, and the satraps, the other two leaders here, begin trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. They want to assassinate this guy. His government competitors in the administration of Darius want to get him out because he's a Jew, and they don't like it. And he outperforms them, and they don't like that either. And so they're going to try to find something about his governmental duties, his daily job, that they can use against him and try to, in effect, nail this guy. But, verse 4, they couldn't find anything. They could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption. Wouldn't that be nice to have a bunch of people in government that you could not find anything on? No evidence of corruption at all? They're so noble and trustworthy and honest that you can't dig up any dirt on them because there is no dirt on them. He was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was found in him. What a difference to what we have to put up with every day. It's the actual antithesis to what we put up with every day. Daniel was so honest and noble in his performance of his job that they had to give up on that approach. They couldn't find anything in his work to use on him. And so they faced the fact in verse 5, he said, well, we're not going to find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. Forget trying to find some deficiency in his job. There ain't going to be one. The only chance we have of nailing this guy is to find some way we can use his faithfulness and dedication to his God against him. So they come up with this scheme. So then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows. King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom and the prefects and the satraps and all these yes men you got over here, boot-licking all the way, they've consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. See the plan? We've all got our heads together, he says. All of us guys that you got in charge of the kingdom here, we got our heads together, and we've decided that you ought to come up with a statute, this law, that says for the next 30 days, if anybody in the empire asks anything of anybody, any king, any god, anybody other than you, you make cat food out of them. Well, why do they need that? You know, you would think maybe he could see past that a little bit and wonder, is this a problem? Do I have this problem in my kingdom? But unfortunately, I think they probably appealed to his ego, and he falls for it. This is something that honors him, and so sounds like a good plan, huh? So they go on and say, now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. That is, if you once establish this law, even you can't change it. The law of the Medes and Persians says once you establish a law, cannot be changed. And they know something about Daniel that is in potential conflict to this law that they're wanting him to set up. They know Daniel beseeches his God and prays to him on a regular basis. So they've just tried to talk Darius into coming up with a law that says if anybody asks of anything of any God other than me for the next month, we're going to let the big cats eat you. So he signed the document. That is the injunction. So he's been had. He's been suckered by these guys. And I think part of the problem, of course, is that it glorifies him, Darius, puts him in a position where nobody can ask anything of anybody for the next 30 days other than him. And he's been had by his own self-glorification. So the deep state in Medo-Persia has gotten their way so far. They've got the law in place that they want there. And they think they got the stage set. Now, when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now, in his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees three times a day, praying and giving thanks before God as he had been doing previously. Now, Daniel knew that this law had been signed. He had this prayer life practice where three times a day he goes up on his roof where there are windows where he can be seen, and he faces Jerusalem and he prays. Later on, they kind of picked this practice up. Solomon started this, I think, earlier, this kind of three times a day facing Jerusalem stuff. And so his enemies know this. They know that he had been doing this. And when he knows that this law has been passed, he continues right on doing the same thing. Why not just vary a little bit? Why not close the windows? Why not do something that allows him to dance around this law for the next 30 days? He refuses to do that. Whatever his practice had been before God, he's going to continue it. So he knows that there's a potential risk here to himself. He knows what the consequences are of being sort of accused by his enemies here. He's probably seen these cats before, and he knows they're big and burly and bad news guys. But he continues right on doing this. He had been doing this previously, and he keeps on doing it in verse 10. Now, earlier, when we saw the incident involving the fiery furnace, the three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they knew that if they violated, it was Nebuchadnezzar's order back then, that there was equal chance of being delivered or being martyred. And they said, we don't care, Nebuchadnezzar. We're not going to obey you even if God does not deliver us. If martyrdom is our lot, then so be it. We're not going to disobey him and obey you. They made the same basic decision that Daniel is making here. These guys are extraordinary, aren't they? These are extraordinary choices to obey God, to not compromise, to not deviate from what he'd been doing. And Daniel makes a similar decision here. Now, does Daniel know the principle that governmental authority is God-given and is limited by God? Does he expect some sort of deliverance here? We're not sure. He doesn't say a whole lot about it at this point in time. His actions would seem to imply that he does. Either that, or he, like the other three guys, is simply accepting his fate, whatever it may be, and he has chosen to obey God regardless of what that fate may be. He is extraordinary in that regard, as they were before. This is as impressive an individual as you're going to find anywhere in the Word of God, is Daniel. So, they go spy him out, verse 12. They approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. He says, hey, didn't you just sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is going to be cast into the lion's den? And the king answered, yeah, that's right. And it was kind of sealed by the law of the Medes and the Persians, which means it can't be changed. So they remind him of the fact that he has set this law in place. Then they said before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, he pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunctions which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. Now notice they don't bother to point out the fact that Daniel is actually being dedicated to God. He said they try to frame this thing. They try to spin it so that Daniel is specifically disobeying Darius. If they don't, he don't pay any attention to you, Darius. It's you that he's showing contempt for. Not that it's God that he's showing reverence for. So it's the old spin number like we see all the time as well today. So when he heard that, when Darius heard that Daniel was not obeying his injunction, he was deeply distressed. And he set his mind on delivering Daniel. This guy likes Daniel. Daniel's doing such a good job for him. He likes him. He's bummed out now that this situation has arisen, that he's in violation of one of Darius's own statutes. So he tries to find some way of getting Daniel out of this. And he kept on working at it and scratching his head and thinking about things and trying different things till sunset. But he couldn't come up with a way to dance around it. The spin doctors had him. He got himself in this position by seeking to glorify himself, and now they've used his own self-servingness to get this situation involving Daniel brought before him. So then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, recognize, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and the Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed. Let us just remind you of this little law here, guy. You can't change this. So then the king gave orders and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, your God whom you constantly serve will himself deliver you. Now, is he hoping that? Is he believing that? I don't know. We can't tell for sure. He at least knows that God can deliver Daniel. Maybe he has faith that God will deliver Daniel. It doesn't appear that he sleeps too well that night, so I'm not sure he really believes this. Maybe he's just hoping. I don't know. But there's at least that hope from him. So a stone was brought in and laid over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet ring of his nobles so that nothing might be changed in regards to Daniel. Humanly speaking, he's in a box. So the king went off and spent the night fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. He's worried. He's concerned. He's very upset over what has just transpired here. Now, apparently the way these lions' dens were made was a big rectangle with a dividing wall between the two sides. Let's say a room like this with a wall going across here. And in that wall would be a door. So what the trainers could do is they could take some meat, throw it in on one side, and get all the animals over onto that side eating the meat, close the door, and then they could clean this side. Then they open the door and they throw some meat on this side from above, and they come in here and they close the door and they go in to clean that side. So it's got a partition so they can move the animals in it to clean and feed and all that kind of nonsense. So apparently you can from above then kind of look down in and see the pit and see what's going on there. So the king went off to his palace, spent the night in fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him. Then the king arose with the dawn, the break of day, and went in haste to the lion's den. Now he must have held out some kind of hope, huh? Or you would just figure you're going to go down and find some scraps, a few bones left around. So he's got some kind of hope here that maybe something has happened here, which again is to his credit. So when he came near to the den, he cried out with a loud voice, and the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions?" So he cries out and asks, he shouts out to Daniel, "Are you there? Did the lions eat you, or are you there?" And Daniel speaks back to him, "O king, live forever." Yeah, he's still there. Saw an article online here the other day about these some hunters in Africa somewhere. Some lions got them and ate them. There were a couple of them. They were, I think one was a hunter and one was a guide. And they got down there where the lions could get to them, and they caught them and ate them, ate those suckers. So they're not above eating people. I think they like other animals better, but they'll eat a person if they get a chance. Well, these guys apparently were actually bred and trained to do that. So he has spent the night now amidst these big cats who eat people, and nothing has happened to him. And Daniel knows why. "My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime." Daniel explains why he's still alive. God has protected him through some sort of an angelic messenger here, because he is innocent of any offense, both to God and to Darius. And the king was very pleased, and he gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatsoever was found on him because he had trusted in his God. Now, in the previous incident in the fiery furnace, same sort of thing resulted, didn't it? Then the three guys were just delivered by the presence of probably the Lord, pre-incarnate Lord. Here, he just simply controlled the appetite of these lions and protected him from their eating him throughout the night. Both cases, divine protection and care was the outcome. And the king was very pleased. He gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den, so Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury had happened to him because of his God. The king gave orders, and they brought those men who were maliciously accused Daniel and cast them, their children and their wives, into the lion's den, and they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. The lions got that meal that they were wanting all that night, didn't they? It's the guys that accused Daniel. You know how many there were there, maybe the other two, maybe more, I don't know. But the sins of those men extended all the way to their families. Their families were devoured. Yeah, sure does, doesn't it? Yeah, in this case, it cost them their lives and the lives of their family members. The lions ate them instead. So Darius makes this decree then after all of this, similar to like what Nebuchadnezzar did earlier. He says to all the people, nations, men of every tongue who were living in the land, may your peace abound. I make a decree that in all of the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear, tremble before the God of Daniel, for he's a living God and enduring forever. His kingdom will come, which will not be destroyed. His dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So he makes this decree after this incident to try to honor the God of Daniel. Now, what do we do with this story? What is the principle here that matters to, one, the readers of Daniel's day, and two, to us today? Well, Daniel's readers, as we noted earlier with that incident involving the fiery furnace, they're going to find themselves during the tribulation period with lions all around them. They're going to be in a fiery furnace during that tribulation period. The Antichrist will turn on them and will try to destroy them, and they will be under difficulty like they have never, the Jews, this, the nation of Israel, like they've never been under before. Two-thirds of them in the land will be killed. So he will be effective at destroying them, and so they will have lions all around them during the tribulation period. They won't be these big cats. There'll be other forms of threats and death at every turn, people trying to hunt them out, root them out, kill them. And this lesson here will be something, I think, that will be very important to them at that time, if not before, but certainly at that time. God has promised to take care of his people. Belief, commitment, promise to obey God, as Daniel did here, will be the basis for their deliverance. And so they will be clinging to this lesson here and the earlier one, chapter 3, about the fiery furnace, I think, during the tribulation period, very, very greatly. And so it will be a lesson for them for sure, for sure. Now, for us, it's a similar lesson. We won't be quite under the same national threat and attack that they will be during the tribulation period in our lives, but we'll have lions nipping at our heels as well, don't we? They just come in different forms. Difficulties and testings and threats and things of that sort will be our lot for sure. We know that in Scripture. We're told to expect that. We're also told, by the way, to face it with a positive attitude. Remember, James said when you fall into all those kind of different testings and trials and so on, be positive about it because it's got a beneficial effect for you. And that's a discipline that is not easy to come by, being positive about a difficult testing or trial. But that's what we're told in Scripture to do. And we're to face our lions by faith like Daniel did his. They just won't be these big felines. It'll be something different, something else. We know they're coming. We know they're not anything extraordinary. There will be commonplace difficulties. Everybody has them. We're told that. God will not bring something into our lives that we cannot possibly endure or bear. He'll provide some way of getting through that, whatever it may be. So the principles for them and the principles for us are very, very similar. They're the principle that God takes care of his own. Faith, belief, obedience is always the basis for God's blessings in our lives, whatever those lions may be. And these guys, or Daniel in this particular case and the three guys before, illustrate that to us about as clearly as anybody in Scripture does. Anybody have any questions or comments about what we saw here in this chapter? Yeah, Mary. God controls the affairs of men.
In control over the government.
Yeah, he is.
Then why is there...
Maybe he's taking a nap somewhere. Maybe he's not on the job. I don't know.
Well, can you repeat that, what you said? He controls...
God controls the affairs of men at all levels of government, at all levels of private life, or anywhere else you want to think of it. God is in control of our lives.
But you were saying that he puts...
That's right. That's right. He can put into place the lowliest of men. Chapter 4. Let me go back and read that for you.
And also, can I get that sheet of the word, the copy?
Can you get what now?
The words.
The writing on the wall.
Oh, the writing on the wall. The meeny, meeny, tuckle. You forcing?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I can probably make you a copy of that. What am I looking for here? See, the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar had to learn there in chapter 4 is that in order that the living may know that the Most, 4:17, in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind, and he bestows it on whom he wishes, and he sets over it the lowliest of men. Governments can be ran by the lowliest of men or by the most noble of men. Most people would think that Nebuchadnezzar was not that great a guy. He was a heathen, an idolater. But God speaks of him as his servant. Daniel spoke highly of him. Daniel cared a lot for him. So God's rulers are not necessarily what we call really high-class believer types. They can be any number of people, but he is in charge, and he puts over the affairs of men whomever he wishes and can put any sort of character there that he might choose.
What is the Medes and the Persians? What do they believe in?
Mean what about?
What do they believe in, like religiously? The Medes?
Oh, they were idolatrous. They had all kinds of gods. Polytheistic. They had one for a variety of different things. The Babylonian god was the god primarily was the god Bel. That's why his name is in some of the names, Belshazzar. But they were polytheistic. They had a number of them, as will all the other empires that we'll see as we get on down through here. Any other question about Daniel's experience? It's a Bible lesson that we tend to gloss over a lot because it's so commonplace, but it's a very important lesson. Those lions are everywhere. Yes, Jane.
Do you think the Senate knew that verse in Daniel that God does put in the...
Probably not, because they don't see themselves as the lowliest of men.
Well,
they wouldn't see themselves in that role, I don't think. There might be one or two of them in there that would understand the scriptures, but not too well. No, they're satisfying self. They're trying to achieve their own will in the affairs of state, and God will be the one that will have the last say. It's just a principle. Now, at times, you, as Mary has brought up the point, you see people in there and you think, well, how in the world can God have anything to do with this character being in government? But it didn't say that everybody appoints is a noble, God-fearing man. He can put in the lowliest of men if he so chooses. So we will see more instances before we're done in this book of how God controls the affairs of state around the world, countries.
Well, he's used the enemies, you know, God's enemies.
Yeah, that's an interesting point there to note in his storyline, isn't it? What happened to the guys that were opposing God's children? They became cat food. They got eaten. And in the fiery furnace, they got burnt up before they can even get the guys in there. So, yeah, God takes care of his own, and at times judgment on people for opposing God's people is clear too. God will judge the nations that hurt Israel.
Yes.
He uses the nations to punish Israel, the Assyrians and the Babylonians. Then he uses other nations to judge them. So they pay a price for harming God's children. Any other questions or comments? You got 30 seconds if there's something more you want to say. We'll go ahead and zero those out and let you go. We'll see you next week, Lord willing. Have a good one.